Afternoon, everybody. I appreciate y'all having me. My name's Herb Phelan. I'm from Parkland. Just a real quick show of hands. Who here bills themselves as either a trauma surgeon or a burn surgeon? Okay, good. That's actually a little better representation than I would have hoped for. So I'm going to be talking today about what, from a palliative care standpoint, the first 48 hours should look like after you admit an injured patient to the hospital. Don't have any disclosures, but I'm sure working on trying to get some. So in terms of the objectives, really the big things that I want to talk about are two in the limited amount of time I've got. The first, my research group has come up with some prognosis calculators that I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about. And as I described to Dr. Easton, a shameless act of self-promotion. And then the other thing we're going to talk about as well is what to do when you're dealing with an injury that you consider to be non-survivable, some tips and tricks. So back in my younger and more impetuous days, when I still believed things like there were great cases after midnight, I thought that the marker of a good trauma surgeon was how many Bogota bags you had over clamshell thoracotomies in the intensive care unit at any given time. But as I've matured, I've really come to find that the family room is, frankly, from my perspective, a harder place to really deliver good care than it is in the operating room. Because a lot of people say they do it well. I've watched a bunch of them do it. I have my doubts about that. But while we all do it, in my opinion, in the trauma and burn world, particularly in the burn world, it's the minority of people who actually do it well. So a lot of y'all are probably familiar with these paradigms, the old paradigm of all-out aggressive care until an abrupt transition to palliative care occurs. But the bottom figure is one that you'll see a lot more these days. It's the more enlightened model of parallel care with palliative care, with the role of palliative physicians becoming more or less, depending on the clinical course at the time, but that they have earlier involvement. Now, that's great. I like I said, I characterize it as being enlightened, and I encourage my palliative care colleagues to get involved early and often. But the one thing about that model is that it takes time. And frankly, you know, the time that it takes to establish rapport and to establish relationships with patients and their families, when we're talking about the first 48 hours after trauma, war or burn, it's really different. And the things that make the first 48 hours different are, if you think about it, we're making decisions in real time that have very big consequences. A lot of them are irreversible. The patients themselves frequently can't go taking part in any decisions. They're intubated. They're got brain injuries. They, even if they're not intubated, their head is still spinning from their injury, and then the chaos of the resuscitation room, they're in pain, very often intoxicated. It's just really, really difficult for them to go meaningfully taking part in any kind of decision making. And from the family's perspective, I mean, they've all just gotten the phone call at 3 a.m. that we dread, right? I mean, they come to the hospital, they're in shock. It's really, really hard to go having quality conversations with them at that period of time. And then finally, specialist palliative care is even more problematic in the middle of the night. We talk a lot about the generalist palliative care skill set and the specialist palliative care skill set. Again, in the middle of the night when these decisions are going down, it makes it difficult to go getting a specialist palliative care colleague on board. So when we talk, that's what I mean when I say that the first 48 hours are different. So really there's two things from a palliative care standpoint that with an injured patient you should be paying attention to at the outset. The first is trying to figure out, okay, is the injury that I'm dealing with non-survivable or not? And then the second part is, okay, if I do think I'm dealing with a survivable injury, starting the process of the dialogue about goals of care. Now, Dr. Mosenthal is going to talk to you a lot about that here in a couple minutes, so I'm not going to dwell on that. I'm sure she'd do a far better job than I could ever hope to. And really, I'm going to go ahead and concentrate more on this part, which is once you get to the point of having the patient tucked into the intensive care unit or you're coming out of the operating room trying to figure out, okay, even with doing everything for this patient, is it a patient who's going to survive or not? So really what I'm talking about is futility. Now, we're fortunate in burns. We've got a pretty well-accepted definition of futility. It's called the Bose score, and most burn surgeons agree that if you take a patient's age and the total body surface area that's burned, if the sum of those two numbers is 130 or greater, we generally consider that to be a non-survivable burn. Now, I can see everybody out there doing their own math in their head, figuring out what TBSA they would be able to tolerate if they were ever burned. It always happens every time I give this part of the talk. But unfortunately, in trauma, we don't wind up having any kind of consensus definitions or guidelines like that. It's a lot more problematic. So I can remember walking out of one family meeting and saying, there's just got to be a better way of doing this. And me sitting there saying, in my experience, we usually see, usually what will happen is. And I took it to our research meeting and said, what we've got a need for a high quality, and in this context, geriatric specific prognosis calculator to help inform these meetings with some objective data. We decided that they had to be easy to understand if we're going and participating, having lay people participate in this. It's also got to be available early. The earlier, the better. And then finally, it's got to be data that is missing, not at random. You know, that's one of the things about sick trauma patients. The sicker they are, the less that tends to get done in the early stages of the emergency room. Things get omitted as you're whisking them off to some intervention. The problem is you can have the best model in the world that correlates with interleukin 43 levels or something crazy like that, but if they're not getting it drawn, it doesn't make any sense. So we started from a standpoint of, hey, if the Bose score works in burns of just age and TBSA, total body surface area burned, is it possible that it could be that easy in trauma, just the age and the injury severity score? Could it be that easy? Well, as is the case with most things where the answer is, could it be that easy? The answer was no. We did an National Trauma Data Bank query trying to find some model that we could create. We even threw comorbidities in, but because of the lack of granularity of the data, didn't work out. We had to go back to the drawing board. So we said, okay, what we really think we're missing here is some kind of a marker of physiology. And that's one of the nice things about red cell transfusion. You've got to be sick if you're getting blood, and it's always going to be charted. So using that, then age, the injury severity score, and whether you got a transfusion, we had much, much better, much more success in creating a model that did a good job of predicting mortality after a geriatric admission. We called it the geriatric trauma outcome score. It's the eight patient's age plus 2.5 times their injury severity score. Let's see if I can get this laser pointer to work. A little far off. All right, we won't worry about that. And then the coefficient 22, if they had been transfused blood. And we got a very nice sigmoid-shaped survival score. And here's a hypothetical case of it. Let's say you get a 78-year-old with who's had a head injury with a craniotomy, a flailed chest, a femur fracture. This comes to an injury severity score of 50. And I should say that this is one weakness of it. You have to be able to calculate ISS scores. Most trauma attendings can. And that patient got 2 units of blood during their resuscitation. That would give them a GTOS of 225, which comes across to here, and an 87% probability of mortality. Great. So we went back to research conference, said, all right, we need to validate this externally. We need a larger sample size. And frankly, I was at a point that I said, I need to get some additional expertise with this. So I went to colleagues around the country who are all at high-performing trauma centers. They all have an interest in this. And we created the Palliate Consortium, the Prognostic Assessment of Life and Limitations After Trauma in the Elderly. And our first job was to go ahead and validate this, and we went from just a 3,800 sample set from the Parkland sample where we created GTOS, and now we had over 18,000 patients, and you can see in the bottom right-hand figure right there, almost identical overlapping survival curves for the GTOS as it relates to probabilities of mortality. So we felt like that validated had an area under the curve at about 0.85, very strong accuracy. So then we said, okay, but what about, we've got to look at things like, we get asked about things like, what's the chances of the patient going to a SNF or an LTAC? We came up with GTOS2. And again, sigmoid-shaped curve. The coefficients changed, but the covariates stayed the same. And this has wound up becoming something that, as we sat down with this information in hand, now we can objectively tell families what the probabilities of their loved one both dying or going to a SNF was. We felt like we advanced the ball. These both of these prognosis calculators are available at our website completely free of charge, www.palliateconsortium.com. Just all you got to do is follow the links. This is what the prognosis calculator looks like. You just plug the values in, and it will give you there on the right the results, your point estimates for chances of dying. And we were so happy. We said, man, we have advanced the ball here. We're slapping each other on the back. Great job, everybody. Clinking glasses, said, all right, let's roll these calculators out now and see how they work in the real world. We did so for about a month. Then we reconvened. It's like, oh, man. Because the problem that we found that we were running into is when you go and you talk to families who are at this stage, all right, and you go in there like for our hypothetical patient, you tell them, okay, your loved one has an 87% probability of dying. You know what they hear? There's a 13% probability that everything's going to go back to normal. And that, I mean, it's understandable in retrospect, but the problem that we had then was, okay, that really this is not something that we ought to be using for families. This really should be more about providers helping you try to determine, are you dealing with futility of care, number one. And number two, even if it's not a non-survivable injury, it kind of helps you couch in your head the point estimates for the likelihood of how hard you should push for comfort care. So let's stipulate for a minute that you decide with a high degree of confidence that you're dealing with a non-survivable injury, though. Let's move on to that. I deal with a very common misconception among both my colleagues as well as my trainees. They will tell me, well, even if you're dealing with futility, if a family member wants everything done, you have a legal and ethical obligation to go providing that care. That's not the case. This has been vetted by the AMA's Ethics Council. And I actually cite this JAMA article from 1999 from the Ethics Council in all my notes where I go talking about this. It absolutely is not the case that you're ethically and legally obligated to go doing it. They actually give you a suggested algorithm for how to go following it, and it's all the things you would expect, getting ethics involved, consultant services involved, trying to get transfer over to another hospital. But if you can't, there at the end, at the bottom left, I don't know if you can read it, but it says, okay to cease the futile intervention. Now, that comes with a big old asterisk, though. And that asterisk says, and this is in the article, by ethics standards, the intervention in question need not be provided, although the legal ramifications of this course of action are uncertain. And lest y'all think that this is abstract and never comes up, we were just dealing with this in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex recently. I don't know if it made the national news or not. It's a 9-year-old girl who unfortunately had a cardiac arrest where she sustained a bad anoxic brain injury. And her parents, she was brain dead, and the parents sued to keep the hospital from taking her off the ventilator. So what wound up happening, it went through multiple restraining orders, things like this. The hospital went through the algorithm, was trying to find a hospital that would accept her and transfer. They were unable to, and it was starting to get pretty contentious. And then the girl wound up expiring while she was on the ventilator while the legal proceedings were ongoing. But this isn't something that's abstract that never comes up. And so what I'm going to conclude with is this, however. If you get to a point where you and the family are just at odds over this, again, keeping in mind that you're not ethically obligated to go doing this, that if you want, there is legal precedent that protects you as a provider. The most common case you'll hear about is this one, Gilgun versus Mass General. It's a case in 1995 with a 72-year-old frail woman who, she had Parkinson's, she fell and broke her hip. Her daughter was her caretaker, and while she initially refused medical treatment, the daughter eventually called an ambulance when the mother was gasping for breath. She went to the hospital on post-injury day 8, where she underwent a hip repair, but then on post-op day 1, began having seizures that it took 5 days to control and left her neurologically devastated. And unfortunately, over the course of a month, she progressed to only grimacing and withdrawing from pain. Neurology had called her functional prognosis dismal. The ICU attending recommended a DNR, and the daughter refused. And on hospital day 28, an ethics consult said that CPR would be inappropriate. She, despite this, given that they were in an impasse, they did go ahead and do a trach and peg on hospital day 45. But over another month, she continued to decline, and the ICU attending set up a meeting with everybody involved, including the hospital lawyers. And at that meeting, the ICU attending used the word futile, but the daughter still demanded a full code, and she kept insisting, my mother's going to recover fully. As things got a little more heated in that family meeting, eventually the daughter threatened the life of the ICU doctor and left while she was verbally berating the ICU staff. They reconsulted ethics, who said that CPR would be unethical. And the ICU doctor, even though the algorithm didn't exist yet in 1995, basically worked it. Went down trying to find another hospital that would accept the patient and transfer, was unable to. Kept trying to keep the daughter in the loop. The daughter just kept referring him to her attorney. And eventually, after a week of trying to find another hospital and not being able to, the ICU attending notified everybody, hey, I'm taking her off the ventilator with no plans to return to the vent should she not be able to breathe on her own. So unfortunately, the lady died 2 days later, and the family immediately sued. And what's notable for this, though, is that the jury only took 2 hours to return a verdict. And that verdict was that while they felt that while the patient herself, had she been able to speak for herself, would have wanted CPR based on what the daughter was telling them, the jury agreed that this constituted futility of care and found no negligence on the part of any of the providers. So the plaintiff said she was going to go ahead and appeal this, but she dropped it right before the proceeding. So given that, this is a legal precedent that protects you if things get this adversarial. Now, having said that, nobody likes seeing their name in the paper. Nobody likes having the sheriff's office knocking on their door with pieces of paper. And given that, I give these doctors all the credit in the world, because I got to tell you, I've put myself in this position and I've wondered, would I have gone through that knowing what I was in store for, that they willingly put themselves through. But they did the right thing. So in conclusion, then, a couple of points. Again, the prognosis calculators I've talked about are really more for yourself as a provider than for the family. Once again, they're available at www.palliateconsortium.com. Free of charge. Did I mention that? Free of charge. And if the injury is survivable, you really ought to be starting to talk about goals of care conversations by about 48 hours. And then finally, if in your opinion the injury is unsurvivable, you're not ethically obligated to go delivering care that the family demands, but you are leaving yourself open to legal risk. So this is New Parkland. I don't know if anybody's seen it yet, but it's a shiny new building. It's really, really nice. If y'all want, come on down. We'll show you around. Thank y'all very much. I'm looking forward to your questions.